It's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he'll be meeting with Russian officials, including President Vladimir Putin, on the way forward in ending the Syrian conflict. His remarks in Washington come amid a cessation of hostilities and the commencement of peace talks in Geneva. They also follow Moscow's decision to withdraw its forces from Syria partially, following a 5.5-month air campaign that bolstered ally President Bashar al-Assad.
I will be traveling next week to Moscow to meet with President Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in order to discuss how we can effectively move the political process forward and try to take advantage of this moment. We know that despite the progress that we've made, despite the reductions in violence and the increases in humanitarian assistance and relief, lasting peace will be impossible without a genuine political transition.
News of Mr. Kerry's Moscow trip came as Syrian peace talks continued for a second day in Geneva and the first Russian military personnel and aircraft returned cheering crowds from Syria. France Tuesday vowed to step up its anti-terrorist cooperation in Africa in the wake of Sunday's Al-Qaeda attack on an Ivory Coast beach resort that killed 18, including 4 French citizens. The French Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault and the Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve arrived in Abidjan, the Ivorian commercial capital. Mr. Cazeneuve praised Ivorian security forces for their quick response to Sunday's attack, the result, he says, of ongoing cooperation. He also announced France is strengthening its security and cooperation with Ivory Coast by stationing elite forces in Mali to intervene in cases of emergency, provide training and assistance. This is VOA News. In U.S. politics, Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio dropped out of the presidential race Tuesday after losing his home state of Florida in a primary election contest. Among the remaining 3 candidates, Governor John Kasich defeated New York real estate businessman Donald Trump in his home state of Ohio, his first victory clearly indicating he's prepared to stay in the race.
We've got one more trip around Ohio this coming fall where we will beat Hillary Clinton and I will become the president of the United States.
Mr. Trump, meanwhile, picked up wins in Florida, Illinois, and North Carolina, as well as the Northern Mariana Islands in the Pacific, and he spoke of the need for unity.
We have to bring our party together. We have to bring it together. We have something happening that actually makes the Republican Party probably the biggest political story anywhere in the world. Everybody's writing about it all over Europe, all over the world they're talking about it. Millions of people are coming in to vote.
On the Democratic side, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton won contests in Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina over lone rival Vermont Senator Bernard Sanders.
Our campaign has earned more votes than any other candidate, Democrat or Republican.
She's comfortably ahead in the number of delegates needed to secure her party's presidential nomination. The White House announced new changes to travel and trade restrictions on Cuba ahead of President Obama's historic visit to the island nation next week. They open up educational travel to Cuba for Americans, allow Cubans working in the U.S. to earn salaries, and reduce trade and financial barriers to improve business ties. Top officials from all 4 major branches of the U.S. military warned U.S. lawmakers Tuesday tight defense budgets have strained their ability to replenish capacity from 2 previous wars, meet current demands, and assure readiness in future conflicts. The Army Vice Chief of Staff General Daniel Allen said the Army is consuming readiness as fast as it builds it.
The Army is accepting considerable risk by reducing end strength while deferring modernization programs and infrastructure investments. These trade-offs are reflections of constrained resources, not strategic insight.
U.S. military spending has declined from nearly $700 billion in 2010 to $560 billion last year. In Ecuador, a military transport aircraft Tuesday crashed in jungle southeast of the capital Quito, killing all 22 on board, including 19 paratroopers. The Argentine Coast Guard sank a Chinese trawler illegally fishing in territorial waters. The crew was rescued. Jailed opposition leader Amadou may be transported out of the country to seek specialized medical attention. Reuters quotes a government spokesman who made the statement Tuesday, days before he contests a runoff election against President Mahamadou Issoufou. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, March 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Economic partners pledge support for Ivory Coast after terror attack.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault said the delegation would like to convey a message of confidence in Ivory Coast. He said upcoming economic meetings will not be cancelled because it is the best way to answer terrorists.
As VOA correspondent Emily Yop in Abidjan, security analysts say Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is expanding its reach in West Africa. A treacherous road ahead as Nigeria takes steps to reform its national oil company. And South Sudan rebels say 23 of their top generals will arrive in Juba on Monday.
This is an indication that Australia is committed to implement the peace agreement signed on 17 August 2015 by the two warring parties.
Colonel William Gadjia Deng is the military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. Zimbabwe faces food and malnutrition crisis as a result of El Nino, and scientists study mummies for signs of colon cancer. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara Tuesday met with delegations from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the IMF, and the French Ministers of Security and Foreign Affairs. The agenda underscored the potentially deep economic impact of Sunday's terror attack. But as Emily Yap reports from Abidjan, all three delegations were upbeat about the country's economic prospects.
Speaking after a meeting with Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara, the French delegation wanted to make it clear Sunday's terrorist attack in Grand Bassam near Abidjan will not change anything. The former colonial power will stand by Ivory Coast diplomatically and economically.
Dans tous ceux qui croient à la liberté, qui croient à la démocratie, et un message de confiance.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault said the delegation would like to convey a message of confidence in Ivory Coast. He said upcoming economic meetings will not be cancelled because it is the best way to answer terror. Ivory Coast has spent the past 5 years working to rebuild its economy after more than a decade of civil war and political crisis. The country's economy has been growing by 8.5% on average and foreign investment are on the upswing. Institute of Security Studies West Africa researcher William Asambo says terrorist attack can have an impact on foreign investors. When something like that happens, he said, foreign investors do not always have the capacity to do an in-depth analysis, and it has a consequence on the entire country, which is deemed unsafe, he said. Also meeting the Ivorian president was a U.S. Chamber of Commerce delegation for talks. Myron Brilliant says the attack will not derail that relationship.
We feel very close to Cote d'Ivoire because we have suffered our own attacks in our country. We understand what's going on here. We understand the significance of it. But in no way will that deter our investment and trade relations here in Cote d'Ivoire. If anything, that encourages us to be more fruitful and more engaged and more positive about our interactions here.
During the attack in Grand Bassam, which was claimed by the jihadist group Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, an International Monetary Fund delegation was visiting for an economic evaluation mission.
De très bons résultats économiques ont été enregistrés par la Côte d'Ivoire pendant les quatre.
An IMF representative says Ivory Coast has had very good economic indicator during the past 4 years, and the economic perspective for the near future is positive. The IMF also said that according to its first estimate, Ivory Coast economy grew 8.6% in 2015. Emilia Provio News in Abidjan.
Sunday's deadly terror attack in Ivory Coast was the latest in a recent string of high-profile attacks in previously untouched parts of West Africa. The attacks have all been claimed by the same group, Al-Qaeda, in the Islamic Maghreb, which now only appears to be bouncing back after the 2013 regional military intervention in Mali, but also shifting strategy. Katerina Hoya reports for VOA from Bamako.
Sunday's attack on a beach resort near Abidjan marked Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb's farthest reach outside its traditional zone of operation. West Africa security analyst Gilles Yabi says this expansion is not new. He says this is definitely not their first attempt in Ivory Coast. He says Abidjan authorities said they stopped one operation 7 months ago. He says as long as Akim has allies all over the region, it's easy for them to conduct these seemingly sophisticated attacks far from the base in northern Mali and the border with Algeria. He says these kinds of attacks do not require a lot of men or resources. Ivory Coast officials say soldiers killed 3 gunmen during the attack Sunday, the same number of attackers cited by Akim in its short statement claiming responsibility. Akim has claimed 2 other similar attacks in the region, both on upscale hotels, both also done with just a handful of gunmen. The first in Bamako in November killed 20 people, the second in Ouagadougou in January killed 30. Akim has its roots in the 1990s Algerian Civil War. The group pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda in 2006. Akim and his allies seized control of northern Mali for 9 months in 2012, only to be chased out of urban centers by French and regional military intervention in 2013. In the past year, northerners and security officials say Akim militants are once again becoming more visible in northern Mali, controlling roads and showing up at local community meetings. Sumaila Boubey-Mega, security analyst and terrorism expert with African Union, says he's also seeing a shift towards a more pan-African terrorist network. He says Akim was traditionally under the command of Algerians. Today, he says, it's an internationalized movement with commanders from other countries as well. However, the recent attacks have correlated with return of fighters loyal to one of those long-time Algerian commanders. Mokhtar Belmokhtar broke away from Akim in 2012. He masterminded a large attack on a gas plant in southern Algeria the following year that killed at least 37 hostages. Both the US and Chadian militaries have claimed in recent years to have killed Belmokhtar in separate operations. Analysts like Yabi believe he may be alive. Yabi says Belmokhtar's experience smuggling cigarettes in the region would mean he knows routes all the way to Burkina Faso and Ivory Coast. He says Belmokhtar at least helped plan these recent attacks and was definitely aware of the operations. Analysts also offer up another theory behind his recent spate of hotel attacks. They say Akim may be seeking to grab headlines as he competes with the Islamic State militant group for recruits. Catherine Haye for VOA News, Bamako.
Reforms are underway at the Nigeria National Petroleum Corporation, or NNPC. It is notoriously secret, allegedly corrupt, and recently unprofitable. As VOA's Chris Stein reports from Lagos, analysts say reforming the company will not be easy.
It is the institution at the heart of Africa's largest oil producer. It represents the Nigerian government's stake in the petroleum industry. But the NNPC has long been dogged by rumors of corruption, perhaps most notably in 2014, when a former central bank governor accused the company of failing to pay the government $20 billion. A report from the Auditor General released this week partially backed that claim, saying the NNPC did not give the government $16 billion in revenues made in 2014. President Muhammadu Buhari was widely expected to overhaul the massive corporation after his election last year. That reform took a major step forward last week when the NNPC's head announced the corporation would be divided into 7 companies, according to local media reports. A spokesman for the NNPC was not available for comment. The company has long been criticized as being wasteful and showed a loss last year. Dauda Garuba, Nigeria officer at the Natural Resource Governance Institute, says downsizing the NNPC would help it both improve oversight and make more money.
When it is broken down, there are then opportunities for each of the units that is coming out as an independent body to pursue business with an eye on profit.
But Matthew Page, a fellow at the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations, says it is unlikely that breaking up the company will be enough to keep it in the black. He cited the NNPC's ownership of the country's 4 oil refineries, which rarely work.
The refineries are obviously a major millstone hanging around the neck of the company. It's really weighing it down. It's the source of a lot of its financial losses. They don't work. They don't provide refined petroleum products to Nigerians.
It will take more than just a restructuring to make the NNPC more transparent, Page said. The company regulates the oil industry while also buying and selling petroleum products itself. And it has little independent oversight since the president fired the board of the NNPC shortly after taking office last year.
All these things are clear conflicts of interest and practices that really are unheard of elsewhere in the world.
President Buhari made the unprecedented decision to personally act as petroleum minister. Page says he must play a more active role in the NNPC's decision-making if the reforms are to be effective. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Today's Wednesday, March 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. We want to send a shout out to listeners on our VOA affiliate, Brela FM in Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. South Sudan rebels say 23 of their top generals are expected to arrive in Juba this coming Monday to prepare the way for the coming of their leader, Dr. Riek Machar, who is the designated first vice president in a soon-to-be-formed national unity government. Mr. Machar has reportedly said he will only travel to Juba when nearly 3,000 of his troops and police are in the capital. Implementation of last August's peace agreement has been slow as both the rebels and President Salva Kiir's government squabble over issues such as President Kiir's creation of 28 new states. There have also been trading accusations of ceasefire violations. Rebel military spokesman Colonel William Gajia Dang says the upcoming arrival of the 23 generals is a further indication the rebels are committed to implementing the August 2015 peace agreement.
23 generals of South Sudan Police, SPLA-IO, will arrive Juba on Monday morning to organize the coming of the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan to Juba. And this is an indication that SPLA-IO is committed to implement the peace agreement signed on 17 August 2015 by the two warring parties. Our coming to Juba also is thoroughly dictated by the Troika by saying that they are not ready to transport the SPLA-IO forces in three locations, which are Pagak, Kaldak, and Tarjas.
Colonel William, for the past weeks I have been speaking with you, or we have been speaking with your group, and you have said that you want to come to Juba, but you have to transport your heavy equipment. So what has changed now? Are you still coming with the heavy equipment?
Yes, exactly. This issue is under discussion, because we told Troika and JMAC that our force would not go to Juba if we don't take this equipment with us, because we had experienced serious consequences during the war. But they told us that within these 2 days, they have to decide and tell us exactly if they would be able to transport this heavy equipment or they choose another option.
I want you to address the ordinary South Sudanese who is listening to you now. Why is it that you need to come to South Sudan with heavy weapons when you are coming to your own country? You're not going to war right now.
We are not coming back to Juba to wage another war, but because we had experienced very serious lessons by the time, then we are going to Juba with all our equipment, then we put them on our cantonment site, just only for implementation of his agreement. But when we are told to go back to Juba, we must take our equipment with us. How could you go back to somebody who fought you using the light machine guns? This would not be possible.
You just gave me good news about the 23 generals coming to Juba. At the same time, you say that you believe that the South Sudan government is not doing its part. So already, people in South Sudan would say, you are not serious. You don't want to come. You just want to blame somebody again.
Of course. That is why so we sent our 23 general of South Sudan police in SPLA-IO to Juba. Because if we don't want to go to Juba, we could not send our general to Juba.
So once the generals arrive, Colonel, how soon before you think your leader, Mr. Riek Machar, comes to Juba?
This arrangement will be prepared soon for him to go to Juba, because when these 23 generals arrive there and meet again with the previous generals who had left for Juba 2 months ago, then they have to prepare the coming of our chairman, which is the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan. I think after they arrive and our troops are transported, maybe so 1 week later, then the chairman so will be there in Juba.
Colonel William Gajia Dang is the military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He was speaking with me from the rebel headquarters in Pagat, South Sudan. The UN Children's Fund says Zimbabwe is facing a food and malnutrition crisis brought on by the El Nino weather phenomena. It says nearly 33,000 children in the country are suffering from severe acute malnutrition and are in urgent need of therapeutic treatment. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
These are the worst malnutrition rates faced by Zimbabwe in more than 15 years. The UN Children's Fund blames what it calls an El Niño-induced drought for creating enormous food shortages, leading to higher levels of malnutrition among children. Zimbabwe has suffered through two consecutive seasons of failed rains, with disastrous consequences for food harvests and family food reserves. UNICEF says food shortages have sent hunger and malnutrition levels spiraling upwards. It says livestock is dying because water sources have dried up. A recent assessment survey shows the number of hungry families in the country has more than doubled to 37% in the past 8 months. Nearly 2.8 million people in rural Zimbabwe will need food assistance, half of them children. UNICEF spokesman Christoph Bouyerak says 2.1% of children under 5 have severe acute malnutrition. The international threshold of 2% triggers an emergency response.
As ever in a crisis of this nature, children face increasing risk of child labor, early marriage, and violence. There are reports of increased physical and sexual violence, teen pregnancy, and child marriage, which are often a kind of coping mechanism in situation of crisis.
UNICEF reports more than one-third of Zimbabwe's households lack a safe water supply. It says this poses a peril for children, especially girls, who must walk very long distances in search of water, putting them at risk of sexual attack. It says lack of safe water also increases the risk of waterborne diseases, including diarrhea, typhoid, and cholera. The agency is appealing for $21 million to provide life-saving and other essential services for children in the coming year. They include nutrition, health, water and sanitation, education and protection. Without this money, it warns things will get much worse for children in Zimbabwe in the coming months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Our next story takes us to a church in Hungary where priests and town folks have been buried and mummified in cool and dry conditions for more than 2.5 centuries. 265 mummies were discovered during a church renovation in 1994. An archive of tissue samples has since attracted researchers worldwide, including a team from Tel Aviv University, which is studying the evolutionary history of colon cancer. Roseanne Scarable has the details.
Colon cancer is associated with obesity, physical inactivity, and processed foods. Scientists have also identified genetic mutations connected to the disease. Tel Aviv University microbiologist Rina Arbisfeld turned to the Hungarian mummies to answer this genetic question.
Do these mutations arise because of our lifestyle or the air or the things we eat or the way we live? Or did these mutations also exist way back?
In other words, is the increase in the incidence of cancer today the result of natural evolution alone? The church mummies presented a rare opportunity for biologists. Unlike Egyptians who deployed special embalmers who carried out the task of mummification quickly, over a period of 2 or 3 months, the naturally desiccated Hungarian mummies had lost their body fluid slowly and naturally. That meant they retained tissue that could be better analyzed for evidence of disease. Arbisfeld and her team isolated DNA samples from 22 mummies and sequenced the genetic material in the hunt for mutations.
It's quite difficult because it's old stuff. It's not so easy to work with. But eventually, after quite a few trials, we were able to find one specific mutation in a gene called APC that we know in these days is involved in the development of cancer.
Arbisfeld hypothesizes that had our ancestors with the genetic mutation for colon cancer lived long enough, they would have developed the disease just like us.
In the same setup, in the same sequence of events, where one mutation leads to another and then to another, because we know these mutations, these specific mutations in the gene called APC, as a gatekeeper for the development of cancer.
Arbisfeld says her next step is to sequence samples from other sources for a larger follow-up study. She says understanding our genetic past can better explain the present and help predict the future. Colorectal cancer accounts for more than 700,000 deaths a year worldwide, but is highly treatable when found early. The study was published in the journal PLOS ONE. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. The Democratic Republic of Congo has withdrawn from the 2017 Africa Under-17 and Under-20 competitions, the Confederation of African Football revealed in Cairo, Egypt, on Monday. Consequently, Chad and Burundi, who were scheduled to play the Congolese in the Under-17 and Under-20 qualifiers, respectively, now advance to the second round without breaking any sweat. In shooting, Egypt's Azmi Mehelba scored 124 points in three rounds to clinch the gold medal at the Cyprus Shooting Grand Prix in the Cypriot capital Nicosia. Russians Valery Shomin, Alexander Zemlin, and Nikolai Tepli placed second, third, and fourth, respectively. In rugby, Morocco outclassed hosts Egypt 38-0 to win the inaugural Arab Rugby Sevens tournament in El Gouna, some 450 kilometers southeast of the Egyptian capital, Cairo. The United Arab Emirates placed third ahead of Saudi Arabia. Morocco will stage this event next year. Meanwhile, Sierra Leone's National Olympic Committee President Patrick Coker says the deadly Ebola virus may have claimed many lives in the country last year, but it certainly has not killed the spirit of sports. Coker made the remarks in the capital Freetown during a week-long sports jamboree that ended on Sunday. The event featured athletics, cycling, fencing, football, handball, judo, lawn tennis, table tennis, rugby, taekwondo, and weightlifting. The sports jamboree was aimed at showing how far Sierra Leone has progressed since the end of the Ebola crisis. During the Ebola crisis, sports gatherings were suspended as a measure to curb the spread of the deadly virus that claimed over 4,000 lives in Sierra Leone. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, March 16th.
This is Bapa Adamare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. The Western world and the world at large wanted to end terrorism and stop extrajudicial killing in the name of religion and jihad. Independent Palestinian state should be mapped out of the Jewish state. This will calm down the nerves of the disheartened and angered Muslim youth worldwide. The world is enough for a while. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's it for this Wednesday, March 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Marco Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We will discuss the World Bank Conference on Land and Poverty. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
You asked for it?
and we're delivering more sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Starting March 21st, the Sunny Side of Sports is expanding to half an hour. Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Tune in starting Monday, March 21st, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.